Hi, and welcome to the Magazine Rack on Chris. I'm Laura Bogart. Today, I'll be reading from the January and February edition of the Smithsonian Magazine. This first article out of the prologue section is written by Michael Capuzzo, and it is titled, The Imp of the Perverse. 2 centuries after his birth, Edgar Allan Poe has become our era's premier storyteller. Elizabeth Becker went all the way from Wisconsin to Philadelphia last July to introduce her 2 young children to America's sacred text, not the Declaration of Independence, but Edgar Allan Poe's The Raven. She walked the kids into one of the most important shrines of the Poe cult, a dark and dreary hallway in the Central Library, and sat them in front of a glass case holding Grip, The Raven, believed to have inspired Poe's great poem, published in 1845. Becker, sitting on the floor with her charges, read aloud from a pop-up book of The Raven. Then she posted the photos on Facebook, where more than 1 million fans of some 100 Poe-themed Facebook pages lurk. It was just another suitably weird tribute to the most influential American author ever. A literary brand beyond the considerable dreams of Twain, Melville, Wharton, Whitman, Hemingway, and Fitzgerald. Like The Great Gatsby and Moby Dick, Poe's The Fall of the House of Usher and The Cask of the Amontillado are among the top 100 books assigned in American college English classes. But Poe is not confined to scholarly debate. Each January 19th, hundreds of Poe fans mark his birthday, 1809, with pilgrimages to Poe sites in Philadelphia, Baltimore, New York, and Richmond. The stories and poems scribed by the half-mad romantic have shaped our national obsession with tales of chaos and darkness, says Kristen Mullingard, an English professor at the University of Hawaii, who has examined Poe's fame. No other American writer has had as endearing and pervasive an influence on popular culture. Go to YouTube and you'll find The Raven, about the ill-omened creature given to chanting Nevermore, read aloud by Christopher Walken, William Shatner, James Earl Jones, and Lisa Simpson, Homer's daughter. Poe's tale have inspired actors such as Bela Lugosi, Boris Karloff, John Cusack, and Huey, Dewey, and Louie. The mathematician Mike Keith reworked the poem so the number of the letters in each word corresponds to the first 740 digits of pi. And only Poe among the literary giants has an NFL football team named for one of his works, the Baltimore Ravens. The team won the Super Bowl in January 2001 with a great defense. Quoth the Ravens, Chris Berman said on ESPN, never score! Poe changed world literature with the first detective story, The Murders in the Rue Morgue, published in 1841. In other words, he made possible about 80% of contemporary literature and television programming, said W. Ocker, author of Poland. With C. Auguste Dupin, a brilliant, eccentric outsider who outsmarts the bumbling constabulary with analytical reasoning, Poe created the forerunner of all fictional detectives to come. In 1904, author Conan Doyle, who created Sherlock Holmes, called Poe the father of the detective tale and complained that Poe had covered its limits so completely that I fail to see how his followers can find any fresh ground which they can confidently call their own. Poe's fictional Tales of Ratiocination, as Poe himself called them, also introduced a style of deduction that influenced real-world crime-solving. Horror writers from Stephen King to H.P. Lovecraft to Justin Cronin, too, claim blood relations with Poe. Earlier European Gothic fiction emphasized the supernatural, castles, and curses. Poe brought horror down from Earth and made us feel the ordinary and everyday. The deranged narrator in The Telltale Heart decides to murder his housemate because he has an evil eye, or maybe just because he wants to. It was the first story of sociopathic horror, says Stephen King, the predecessor of modern nightmares like Thomas Harris's Hannibal Lecter. It may well be that Walt Whitman's poetry and, as Ernest Hemingway would say, Mark Twain's novel Huckleberry Finn created the American vernacular, but Poe gave us the stories we tell and retell. Poe was tuned to the modern age and its rejection of religious taboos against exploring the realms of horror and death. There sits the imp of the perverse with the most entertaining ghastly tales ever told. But he is also the perfect fit for our postmodern age, when each person makes of the demon of mystery and fright what he or she will. Annabel Lee, Poe's ode to a woman loved so intensely the angels grew envious and killed her, is suggested as a reading at weddings. While on YouTube, Goth Girl, her eyelids the green of grave rot, reads the same tale aloud in a cemetery. Poe has long had a reputation as a drunken mad genius, and bohemians, tortured artists, struggling writers, and even drug addicts embrace him as their own. More recently, though, the 2017 PBS American Masters film, Edgar Allan Poe, Buried Alive, downplayed the tortured image. He comes off instead as a smart guy who wanted to become famous, changed jobs all the time, and was fascinated with technology, the HuffPost wrote. Maybe Edgar Allan Poe was the first millennium. Poe's death in 1849 was something the author himself might have written. Missing for nearly a week, he was found incoherent on the streets of Baltimore in clothes that did not belong to him. He died 4 days later at the age of 40. But as Poe famously wrote in The Premature Burial, the boundaries which divide life from death are at best shadowy and vague, and his voice is still heard from beyond the grave. As Acher puts it now, never R.I.P. Edgar Allan Poe. And here's an interesting sidebar article by Bianca Sanchez titled Rituals, Our Favorite Haunts. From roses and cognac at Poe's first resting place to Lincoln's pennies on John Wilkes Booth's grave, the strange tributes to the famed dead. And she lists about 8 examples. We'll start with Douglas Adams. In The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, Adams wondered where lost pens go. The answer? Fans leave them at his London grave. Frederick the Great. As King of Prussia, Frederick II issued 15 decrees promoting potatoes. Today, they crop up at his tomb in Potsdam. John Wilkes Booth. In 1869, the assassin was buried beneath a blank tombstone in Baltimore. Now, it is marked by piles of Lincoln pennies. Marilyn Monroe. The actress's L.A. crypt is stained with red lipstick kisses. Ex-husband Joe DiMaggio sent roses 3 times a week for 20 years. Susan B. Anthony. After the recent election, hundreds of women traveled to Rochester, New York to put I voted stickers on the suffragist grave. Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir. Metro stubs litter the philosophers' graves in Paris. The origin of the tradition is unknown. Jean-Michel Basquiat. Fans bring markers and paint to the New York City cemetery. Some carve his signature crown design into a nearby stump. And last, Sylvia Plath. Some who blame the poet's husband for her death have tried to scrape her married name off the West Yorkshire headstone. This next article is also out of the prologue section, and it is written by Holly Malaya, titled The New Philadelphia Story. 25 years after the breakthrough movie about the AIDS crisis, the city faces another epidemic. These were the early fighters, mostly men, a few women, their faces and thin frames captured in the watercolor portraits hanging in a hallway at Action Wellness in Philadelphia. They're all gone now, lives cut short by a plague. These were done by a local artist who would come in and ask our hospice clients if she could paint them, says Kevin J. Burns, the executive director of the Pioneering Health Center, which until June 2016 was called Action AIDS. Other Action AIDS clients, the healthier ones, were also immortalized as extras in Jonathan Demme's revolutionary film, Philadelphia. Of them, Burns says, only one of them is still alive. In all, some 50 people with AIDS appeared in the influential courtroom drama, which opened across the country 25 years ago this month. Our conference room was made to look like part of a clinic, said Burns, who was among the mingling patients waiting to see a doctor in an early scene. I'm in the corner looking like I'm talking to someone. Nearby, Tom Hanks's character sits alone, anxious for the results of his latest blood work. Philadelphia was the first major studio film to face the AIDS crisis head on, though the industry had lost countless people to AIDS, most famously Rock Hudson in 1985. There was tremendous reluctance to make a movie about the epidemic, especially one focused on those hard hit, the gay community. DeMay and his producing partner, Ed Saxon, had both just won Oscars for The Silence of the Lambs and were in a position to take a creative risk. Both were personally inspired to center their next big project on the subject. Demme, by the Spanish illustrator Juan Suarez Botas, a close friend who had been diagnosed with AIDS, and Saxton in tribute to his friend Robert Breslow, a writer who was suffering from the disease. Everybody knew somebody, Saxton recalls. Filming for Philadelphia began in October 1992. By the end of that year, more than 194,000 people had died from AIDS in the United States. Just a year later, as the movie opened, the death toll had surged to 234,225. Dumais and his protege, screenwriter Ron Niswehr, conceived of the basic story. Dumais and his protege, screenwriter Ron Niswehr, conceived of the basic story of a gay lawyer with AIDS who sues his high-powered law firm for wrongful termination. Niswehr recalls pitching the concept to then Orange studio head Mark Platt. His reaction was, "Guys, there are 10 movies in development right now about AIDS, and all of them have a heterosexual main character. That's immoral. We're going to make the movie about AIDS that should be made." The script and Oscar-winning team had no problem attracting stars. After wrapping Sleepless in Seattle, Hanks lost almost 40 pounds to embody the AIDS-stricken Andrew Beckett, who, unable to find an attorney willing to take his case, ends up with a homophobic ambulance chaser named Joe Miller, played by Denzel Washington. What better pairing of client and lawyer to illustrate the prejudices exasperating the plague? We said from early on, we're not looking for an audience that knows somebody with AIDS. The audience has a lot more in common with Denzel's character than Tom's character, Saxton says. So much of the crisis was about people being homophobic. Perfect in retrospect, the city of Philadelphia wasn't the filmmaker's only choice for this tale of prejudice and how it can be overcome. New York, Boston, Chicago, and Baltimore were all considered. I got a call from the producer telling me they were looking for a real courtroom where they could shoot for a long time, recalls Sharon Pinkerson, executive director of the Greater Philadelphia Film Office. I said, "I've got a courtroom for you." They came to see what we had, and I remember walking with them on JFK Boulevard and pointing to City Hall and saying, "There it is." Jonathan said, "That's City Hall." And I said, "Yeah, but that's our courthouse." Mary Steenburgen, who plays the law firm's steely defense lawyer, recalls her first day of shooting in room 243 of the ornate castle-like landmark. 2 days before filming, I went to visit my friend Peter, who was dying of AIDS, Steenburgen says. I was so sad about him. I couldn't separate myself emotionally. My first day of work isn't even in the movie. That's never been true of any day of my career. I sat down with Jonathan at the end of the day and I said, "I'm a wreck. I don't know if I can play this part." And he said, "Mary, it's not about AIDS. It's about everybody in this country is entitled to justice. They're entitled to their representation." And from then on, I was fine. The title seems obvious too, but it wasn't the first choice either. At various points, the script had been called At Risk, People Like Us, and Probable Cause. But naming the movie after the city underscored the huge role Philadelphia itself played in the film, with its sui generis energy of sights and sounds and real-life characters. The city of brotherly love, the Declaration of Independence, I mean, perfect, right? Niswehr says now. Earning $200 million at the box office and several Oscar nods, the film was a catalyst for conversations, acceptance, and other film projects that might never have made it out of the closet. Thanks in part to that kind of AIDS education and awareness, the stigma of the disease is no longer as strong in the United States, though homophobia is still an issue. There's still a tremendous amount of discrimination, Saxton says, but he is hopeful that too is changing. My daughter came to work as an intern on a TV show, and she was filling out paperwork that asked, "Male or female?" He chuckles. She looked at me and said, "Really, Dad? Those are the only two choices?" A small red Christmas ornament, its hook taped to a shelf, dangles over Kevin J. Burns' desk. It was around the holidays that Philadelphia finished filming. Members of the production got to know people in the community, and before leaving, Tom Hanks surprised a family with a decorated tree and gifts. The cast and crew and directors were very generous, Burns remembers, sitting at a table drinking tea with his executive deputy director, Beth Hagen. He smiles. "See that Christmas ball? I swiped that off the tree so I could say, I have one of Tom Hanks's balls." Everyone laughs. Jean-Marie Zippo, a behavioral health specialist with Action Wellness, joins us, and the three share stories with extraordinary warmth and ease that come from having worked together at the clinic for almost 3 decades. soldiers in a protracted war who have gained ground but are facing new battles. They remember the darkest days of the AIDS crisis. Says Burns, I'm the only one surviving of my gay men friends who were there then. In the early years, people were dying so quickly, he remembers, and there were only a handful of doctors in Philadelphia who would treat AIDS patients, and only one funeral home. When I think of Philadelphia, says Hagen, I think of a client I had who was actually an extra in the movie. Her mother said, you can't eat with us. You can't share anything. She was so ostracized and alone. She pauses. I always have her in my heart. It was not unusual to have a client die every week, Burns says, getting up and bringing a box of tissues to the table. That was the nature of the work we did. As a country, we talk a lot less today about AIDS as medical advances have made HIV, the virus that causes AIDS, a manageable disease. But it is still very much with us. In 2016, in the United States, nearly 40,000 people were diagnosed with HIV, almost 500 in Philadelphia. In 2017, there were an estimated 1,200 fatal opioid overdoses in Philadelphia. In contrast, there were only 935 deaths during the worst year of the AIDS epidemic in the city. Opioids are the new plague, says Burns. Codeine, oxycodone, fentanyl, heroin. Today, any one of them can be bought on the streets of Philadelphia's Kensington neighborhood, a blue-collar factory community in the 1950s. The area has been known as the Badlands since the 1980s because of gangs and drugs and addicts. Zippo personally sees the marketing of pharmaceuticals to the public as a contributing factor. People become more and more accustomed to the idea that every boo-boo has a fix, and that fix is in a pill. Take that pill, and the pill reinforces an immediacy. She continues, there's more and more trauma that is being identified. Substance abuse is definitely based in trauma. She sighs, I have real fondness for that population. I have a place in my heart for opioid-dependent people. They see the parallels to the AIDS crisis more clearly than they would like to. Even those who seek help for opioid addiction are stigmatized, they say. There's a tremendous amount of misinformation, stereotypes, and hostility, says Zippo, of methadone treatment. People keep it very hidden because there's a lot of discrimination. Burns leads everyone to the conference room, nearly identical to the one where the clinic scene in Philadelphia was shot 25 years ago. A painting from the movie hangs in the same spot, a Jackson Pollock-like abstract in pastel colors that takes up most of one wall. There's a big basket of yarn balls atop a conference table where several healthy action wellness clients are all sitting and knitting and chatting away. Don't mind us, ladies, Burns says, smiling. We all pose in front of the art piece while a staffer snaps pictures. Burns admits he almost threw the painting out when he was on a cleaning kick. He'd forgotten it was in the film. Zippo stopped him. It is from an Oscar-winning movie. What would Philadelphia look like today? It would be about people with HIV who are transgender, who are forced into sex work to survive, who are arrested and abused by the police and criminal justice system, Burns says. Zippo says, it would be a gay man of color, coming from a poor background. With an addiction, adds Hagen. He could be played by Denzel Washington. This next article, also out of the prologue section, is written by Dan Jones and is titled The Color of History. An artist shows us that the past was not black and white. On January 18, 1944, the Metropolitan Opera House rocked to a sound it had never heard before. In the words of a reporter in attendance, a 10-piece all-star swing band shook the August walls with its hot licks and about 3,400 alligators. Jazz fans beat it out through every number. The Esquire, an all-American jazz concert, was a far cry from the venue's usual fare. Just picture swinging shoulders, catcalls, squeals, screeching whistles, and a rhythmic tattoo of hands while Sir Thomas Beecham was conducting, say, Rigoletto, the reporter wrote. Appearing that night, 75 years ago, were some of the greatest jazz musicians in history. Benny Goodman played a number live from Los Angeles via radio link, while Louis Armstrong, Billie Holiday, and Mildred Bailey took the stage. Bailey, a fixture in New York's hottest jazz clubs, is less well-remembered today than her contemporaries. But a poll of leading music writers around that time of the Opera House concert ranked her as the second-best female jazz singer in the world, just behind Holiday. Although no longer in perfect health, she suffered from diabetes and had been hospitalized for pneumonia the previous year, Bailey still belonged among the musical elite, as her friends and fellow stars Bing Crosby and Frank Sinatra recognized. At the Met, Mrs. Swing thrilled the crowd with her signature rockin' chair. Jean Mili, the great Albanian-American photographer whose work was made famous in Life magazine, captured the event. One of Millie's photographs shows Bailey rehearsing backstage, accompanied by Roy Eldridge on trumpet and Jack Teagarden on trombone. The original image was shot in black and white. This new version has been created for Smithsonian by the digital artist Marina Amaral, who uses Photoshop to add colors to historical pictures. Amaral, 24, has colorized hundreds of photographs, with the aim of giving a new perspective on the past. Color affects human beings in powerful ways. For at least 200 years, scientists have proposed links between different colors and emotional responses. For example, red elicits feelings of excitement, and blue, feelings of relaxation. Recent studies have suggested that we are acutely sensitive to small variations in the hues of others' faces. Exposure to different colors has also been shown to affect our moods, choices, appetites, and intellectual performance. Exactly why has not been adequately evaluated, but the popular response to work by Amaral and to projects such as the Smithsonian Channel's America in Color, which features colorized film clips, shows that the technique can deepen the connection viewers feel with historical figures and events. Colorizing photographs is a process that requires a combination of careful factual research and historical imagination, says Amaral, a former international relations student who now works full-time on historical images from her home in Brazil. Amaral is often drawn to a photograph by the small details, like the tendrils of smoke from an onlooker's cigarette, but says she always looks for an image that allows me to tell a broader story. Her main task here was to create a new portrait of Bailey that was sensitive to her family heritage, which was unusual for the jazz scene at the time when many of the most famous musicians were black. Bailey, by contrast, was raised by her mother, a tribal member on the Coeur d'Alene Reservation in Idaho. Although Bailey was often perceived as white in an era when Native Americans suffered widespread discrimination, this made colorizing a challenge. There are no known color photographs of Bailey, and the original image doesn't provide many clues, so Amaral looked for scraps of information in sources describing Bailey. She also turned to the color portrait of Bailey done by Howard Coslow for the 1994 U.S. postage stamp, though that portrait, also based on a black-and-white photograph, wasn't conclusive. Amaral is careful to point out that her works are not about restoration, but about interpretation. They are as much about encouraging questions about past events as depicting them objectively. What isn't in doubt is the ability of color to transform the way we understand even the most familiar sights. As Bailey herself once sang, "I used to be colorblind, but I met you, and now I find there's green in the grass. There's gold in the moon, there's blue in the skies." And now I'll read a small article written by Amy Crawford titled, "The Last First on Earth? The Pole of Inaccessibility Has Eluded Adventurers for More Than a Century." Alexandra Kolchak is best known as the man who led the White Russian government that opposed the communists in the revolution and who was executed by the Bolsheviks in 1920. But explorers and geography nerds remember Kolchak as the young Russian Navy officer who, just 11 years earlier, calculated the whereabouts of the most remote place in all of the vast Arctic, a spot some 400 miles from the geographic North Pole that he said was permanently covered with the ice fields of the Arctic pack and inaccessible to navigation. Because nothing is more alluring than a place that supposedly can't be reached, the pole of inaccessibility would become an irresistible challenge for generations of adventurers. And it still is. Numerous expeditions have tried to cross the churning sea ice to reach the theoretical pole, the location in the Arctic Ocean farthest from any land. They failed in part because the exact location has shifted over the years with the discovery of previously undetected islands. In 2013, researchers using high-resolution satellite imagery and mapping software placed the pole of inaccessibility at 86 degrees north latitude and 176 degrees east longitude, or about 125 miles from Kolchak's original. Gareth Rees, a physicist with the Scott Polar Research Institute at the University of Cambridge, who collaborated on the new finding, is confident they have it right, for now. Climate change and rising sea levels may eventually reshape coastlines and thus move the pole. The veteran Arctic explorer Jim McNeill of England has launched two expeditions to prove that the pole is accessible after all, but he was thwarted by illness in 2003 and disintegrating ice in 2006. This February, in the most ambitious attempt yet, McNeill and 28 volunteers will set out again from northern Canada. They'll travel on cross-country skis and pull sleds that double as kayaks in case they encounter open water. As the world gets smaller, the pole of inaccessibility beckons as one of the few remaining firsts in exploration. McNeill says, "I'm amazed that there still could be a place no one has ever reached." Now let's end with Ask Smithsonian. You've got questions, we've got experts. Question: why are starfish shaped like stars? Scientists can't pinpoint exactly why starfish evolved to have radial symmetry, with arms, usually five, but as many as 40 in some species, growing from a central axis. However, Dave Pawson, senior scientist at the National Museum of Natural History, notes that the arrangement confers certain advantages on the animals, which, lacking a backbone, aren't technically fish. At the tip of each arm is an eye that can detect changes in light intensity, and on the bottom are tube feet that enable it to move in any direction. Several species of starfish can regenerate an arm lost to a predator or an accident, and a few can even regenerate a new central disc from a severed arm, as long as a fragment of the disc remains with the arm. Question: why were teacher colleges called normal schools? Thank France, the phrase is derived from École Normale, which was used for institutions designed to instill standards of pedagogy and curriculum in teachers-to-be, says Debbie Schaefer-Jacobs, associate curator in the Division of Cultural and Community Life at the National Museum of American History. America's first state-sponsored normal school opened in Massachusetts in 1839, at the urging of public education champion Horace Mann. It is now Framingham State University. More arose through the mid-19th century, in parallel with the development of public schools, then called common schools. By the 1930s, however, most normal schools were calling themselves teachers' colleges. Question: the night skies of the northern and southern hemispheres have different constellations. Can you see that difference as soon as you cross the equator? No, says Rebecca Lundgren, an astronomy educator at the National Air and Space Museum. The differences become more apparent as you get farther from the equator, or closer to the North or South Pole. Depending on the time of year or your latitude, you can still see many of the same constellations in either hemisphere. At the equator, you can see all parts of the sky if you're patient. The Southern Cross and the North Star will be really low on the horizon and hard but not impossible to spot. Question: I've heard that all kinds of artists used to live at Carnegie Hall. Is that true? It is. Shortly after the hall was built, in 1891, two towers containing 170 rental studios were added. They provided the hall with an additional source of income, and artists a place to live and work. Through the 20th century, the residents made up a remarkably vibrant community of musicians, dancers, and painters, says Jennifer Coleman Bracci, a reference librarian at the Cooper Hewitt Smithsonian Design Museum. Among the better-known tenants were Leonard Bernstein, Marlon Brando, and the fashion photographer Bill Cunningham. The last renters were evicted in 2010 as the Carnegie Hall Corporation moved to renovate the towers into spaces for archival storage, teaching, and rehearsals. Well, that's about all the time we have for today on the Magazine Rack. I've been reading from the January-February edition of the Smithsonian Magazine. Thanks for listening to Chris. I'm Laura Bogart. So long until next time.